On This Week in Enterprise Tech, we have Mr. Brian Chi, Mr. Curtis Franklin on the show today. Now, building company culture around security is a huge challenge. The question is, where do you start? We have a great discussion about establishing a security culture. Now, the gig economy and workforce has seen growth over the years. What it's shown us is there's some challenges with stability on financial volatility. Today we have Ben Verde Chapman. He's Chief Growth Officer of GigWage on the show. And we're going to discuss the financial needs of the gig worker and what benefits they may need to reduce the impact of income volatility. You definitely shouldn't miss it. Twyatt on the set.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 494, recorded May 20th, 2022. Dig the gig. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Linode. With Linode, there's no hidden fees, and you can scale up or down without penalty. Get $100 in credit. Visit linode.com/Twyatt. And by Compiler, an original podcast from Red Hat discussing tech topics big, small, and strange. Listen to Compiler on Apple Podcasts or anywhere you listen to your podcasts. And by Plextrack, the proactive security management platform. Save time and increase productivity with the premier cybersecurity reporting and workflow management product designed to support the complete security lifecycle from assessment through remediation. Visit plextrack.com/twit to claim your free month. Welcome to Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world's connected. I'm your host, Louis Maresca, your guide through this big world of the enterprise. But I definitely can't guide you by myself. I need help from the professionals, the experts, starting with senior analyst at Omdia and security enterprise expert, Mr. Curtis Franklin. Welcome back, Curtis. What's been keeping you busy?
Well, the last day or so, the thing that's been keeping me busy is working with the Maker Effects Foundation at MegaCon in Orlando. You know, MegaCon is a huge comics convention, and this is the first full year back. Last year, we were there, but people were very tentative. This year, there's no hesitation. And they are estimating a massive crowd. We've been very busy, and we do this to get the word out about our foundation. We are many things. We are a maker space. We produced Maker Faire Orlando, but one of the big things we do is support STEM education around Central Florida. And it's wonderful to see some of these younger people getting really excited about making things, about getting involved with science and technology and solving problems, whether those problems would seem to us adults to be small right now, they can grow to big solutions for big problems in the future. So really neat thing to be able to do.
Such a great organization. I'm looking forward to see what you guys do coming up. Speaking of coming up, though, I think you're getting ready for RSA, right? Anything you're looking forward to there?
I'm looking forward to surviving RSA. my inbox is absolutely full. And right now I'm in that glorious stage of scheduling where you're trying to remember to leave yourself time to walk from one appointment to another. Again, it's been a while since we were able to get together on a huge scale as an industry. Right. And so lots of people are planning to be there. Lots of people want to meet face-to-face. And I'm looking forward to coming away with lots of great things to write about and to talk about. So, yeah, it's coming up in about 3 weeks. Should be exciting. I'm going to have a very busy June. Some of which I'll actually get to spend here in Orlando.
Fantastic. Well, we'll look out for what you have to write. Well, folks, speaking of exciting, we also have to welcome back our net architect, Sky Fiber, and all-around tech geek, Mr. Brian Chi. Chibert, great to see you, my friend. What projects have kept you busy this week?
I'm actually at the same MegaCon conference with Kurt.
Okay, cool.
I'm actually working with the Learn to Solder portion. And we've got little flashy buttons that you can practice soldering on. It's a lot of fun. But I'll tell you, big shout out to one of the members of our makerspace, Miss Allison Chase. For those of you that were big fans of Zelda, she has made a cosplay costume that is a guardian. And it has lots and lots of blinky lights, and it's got laser beams and all kinds of stuff. And she is in the cosplay contest, and big cross my fingers for Allison. Lots of fun, lots of good things to see, and, you know, come on down. We'd like to see some of the Twilight Ride if you're in the Central Florida, and we're in the Orange County Convention Center, room 331. Come by and say hi. I'll be there, and Kurt will be there most of the day during MegaCon.
Thank you, Chiebert. Well, speaking of lots of big things to see, we have lots of big things to talk about here on the About Enterprise here on the show. So we should definitely get started. Now, building company culture around security is definitely a huge challenge. The question is, where do you start? Well, today we have a great discussion about tearing down an anti-security culture in your organization and getting started. Now, the gig economy and workforce has seen growth over the years. Now, what it's shown is there's actually challenges with stability and financial volatility there. Now, we have Ben Verde Chapman on the show today. He's Chief Growth Officer at GigWage, and we're going to discuss the financial needs of the gig worker and what benefits they may need to reduce the impact of income volatility. So definitely stick around. Lots of fun stuff to talk about. But first, there's been lots of going around in the enterprise. So let's go ahead and jump into this week's news blips. The president of Costa Rica, Rodrigo Chavez, was only in office for about a week when the Costa Rican government computer systems were hit with ransomware. The cyber attack started in late April, but the Russian-speaking Conti gang has now tried to increase the pressure to pay a ransom by raising its demands to $20 million and claiming that its goal was to actually overthrow the government. That's right. Now, the attack hit a large surface area with 27 government institutions impacted, including municipalities and state-run utilities. Now, Chavez has gone on record saying that the attack was coming from inside as well as outside Costa Rica. Now, the Conti group has warned that they were also working with people inside the government. Now, their quote, "We have our insiders in your government," the group said. "We are also working on gaining access to your other systems. You have no other options but to pay us. We know that you have hired a data recovery specialist. Don't try to find workarounds." There's been lots of talk about this attack, and most analysts, including the U.S. State Department, feel that the Conti group is using the overthrow threat as a distraction more than an actual threat. However, the Conti ransomware variant has now been branded as the costliest strain of ransomware ever documented. Now, let's hope the Costa Rican government can now come out on top without adding Conti's bottom line.
Hey, are you running a Kubernetes API on a server? Well, according to researchers with the Shadow Server Foundation, the odds are pretty good that your server is open to the internet. Researchers discovered more than 380,000 open Kubernetes API servers. That's 84% of all global Kubernetes API instances exposed on the internet. Now, the researchers did not do any intrusive checks to figure out the level of exposure for the servers, but there's no way to say that this news is good. The greatest number of exposed API servers was found in the U.S., where some 201,348, that's 53% of these open API instances, were discovered. And the problem isn't really unique to the Kubernetes API. According to a 451 research study, large enterprises, on average, have more than, get this, 25,000 APIs connected to or operating inside their infrastructure. APIs tend to be one of the weakest links in cloud infrastructure management because they're frequently found at the heart of the control plane. That's the thing that manages cloud infrastructure and application configuration. This report is yet more evidence that many organizations are simply not prepared to protect against, respond to, or even have visibility into potential API attacks. Now, this is especially troubling because analysts believe that less than 50% of enterprise APIs will be managed 3 years from now, as explosive growth in APIs surpasses the capabilities of API management tools. Do you know how many APIs you have exposed? Are you sure about that number? Now could be the perfect time to figure out the number and bring each and every one of those APIs under solid security management.
Well, this Wired magazine article really got me concerned. So when you turn off an iPhone, it doesn't fully power down, especially on the newer ones. Chips inside the device continue to run in low power mode that makes it possible to locate lost or stolen devices using Find My X feature or use credit cards and car keys after the battery dies. Well, researchers have devised a way to abuse this always-on mechanism to run malware that remains active even when an iPhone appears to be powered down. It turns out that the iPhone's Bluetooth chip, which is key to making features like Find My work, has no mechanism for digitally signing or even encrypting the firmware it runs. So academics at Germany's Technical Institute of Darmstadt figured out how to exploit this lack of hardening to run malicious firmware that allows the attacker to track the phone's location or run new features when the device is turned off. Well, my comment is, ouch, and yet another reason why we can't have nice things. I'm going to also predict that this also means grabbing physical access credentials from phones isn't that far behind, keeping in mind that traditional proximity cards and fobs are falling out of favor quickly to be replaced by NFC and Bluetooth on your phone.
This is from Bloomberg News. Now, Tesla vehicles continue to be targets of researchers. In fact, according to Sultan Kasim Khan, principal security consultant at the Manchester, UK-based security firm NCC Group, a new hack is effective on the Tesla Model 3 and Y cars that allowed a thief to unlock a vehicle, start it, and speed away. You may be asking yourself, how is this possible? Well, according to the report, by redirecting communications between a car's owner's mobile phone or key fob and the car, outsiders can fool the entry system into thinking the owner is located physically near the vehicle. Now, the good news is there is no evidence that thieves have actually been able to exploit this on vehicles yet. However, Tesla in April acknowledged that they relay attacks are known limitation of a passive entry system. Now, according to Khan, even though Tesla knows about the issue, they have yet to fix it. That's because to fix it, Tesla would need to alter its hardware and change its keyless entry system. Now, BLE, or Bluetooth Low Energy Protocol, was designed to conveniently link devices together over the internet, though it's also emerged as a method for hackers to exploit to unlock smart technologies, including house locks, cars, phones, and even laptops. Now, an attacker could walk up to any home at night if the owner's phone is at home with a Bluetooth passive entry car parked outside and use this attack to unlock and start the car. Now, once the device was near the fob or phone, the attacker could then send commands from anywhere in the world. Kind of scary. Now, that means it just might be worth thinking about turning off some of those convenience features that you have on your Tesla there. For now, maybe until it's safe method or even a safer method for securing it is found. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, we have the News Bites. But before we get to the News Bites, we do have to thank a really great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Linode. Linode offers the industry's best price-to-performance value for all compute instances, including shared, dedicated, high-memory, and GPUs. Get free DDoS, cloud firewall, unfiltered API access, and more. Linode offers predictable flat-free pricing, which is universal across all 11 of his data centers. If you haven't chosen Linode yet, you might be thinking, why choose Linode? Well, get support experience above the rest. People choose Linode because they demand a better customer support experience. Linode's independence and mission drive them to a different standard where the customer is driving force behind everything they do. They have pay-as-you-go, predictable, and transparent pricing. In fact, Linode pioneered the predictable flat pricing model for cloud computing. No more anxiety over hidden costs. They make it simple to launch and scale in the cloud because with Linode, you'll get flat pricing across every global data center, an intuitive cloud manager, a full-featured API, best-in-class documentation, and award-winning support. That means that Linode makes it easy to manage your applications in the cloud. Not only that, but with Linode, they have proven secure and reliable enterprise-grade infrastructure with their extensive peer relationships and their next-generation network. Linode delivers the modern infrastructure and performance you need to innovate at scale. I have found with Linode, they are a one-stop shop, so you don't have to look anywhere else. Whatever you want to do, you can host your website or build your app, store your or back up your media. Plus, you can easily launch and enrich your developer applications, hosted services, websites, AI and machine learning workloads, gaming services, or even your CI/CD environments. And you can launch and scale in the cloud with their virtual machines. You can even choose their shared and dedicated compute instances, or you can use your $100 in credit on S3 compatible object storage, manage Kubernetes, and much more. And there are a lot of cloud providers. No, you think about it. There's actually a lot of cloud providers out there, and they don't make things easy to be productive. In fact, some of them have a ton of dashboards coming out their ears. Well, not with Linode. I actually found them really easy to use. In fact, Linode was rated the easiest to use by G2 Crowd in 2021. That's why developers, cloud developers, choose Linode, because they make managing complex cloud infrastructure easy with simple bundled pricing, full-featured API, and 100% human support. Linode helped pioneer cloud computing back in 2003, with 3 years before AWS. They have the longevity you know can be trusted. With Linode, there's no hidden fees, and you can scale up or down without penalty. Get $100 in credit. Visit linode.com/Twyatt. That's linode.com/Twyatt. And we thank Linode for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, we now have time for the bites. That's right. Now, building company culture around security is a huge, huge challenge. Curtis, what are organizations to do?
Well, Lou, it can be a huge problem. You know, something that we talk about a lot in the security business is building a security culture. And that's usually seen as the end game in cybersecurity awareness training. You know, you teach your employees all about cybersecurity. You tell them what's important, what to do about it, all this. And finally, if you do it right, cybersecurity becomes part of the overall culture of your organization. Well, for many companies, the first step has to be not building this security culture, but tearing down an anti-security culture. Well, who could be against security, you say? Here's what's happening. We are, especially in North America, a general culture that values efficiency, values winning, values moving forward, values productivity at all costs. And security is often seen as something that slows that down. Now, from the old stereotype of cybersecurity as the department of no, to security as something that adds friction to transactions because it asks you to do things like re-authenticate or follow a procedure or follow a process, anything that takes away from simply getting the job done. Now, in some companies, this culture of just getting things done is so pervasive that employees feel that they must go around or ignore or somehow subvert anything that doesn't contribute to their efficiency, to their productivity, to their sales success, or meeting their KPIs, or whatever it might be. So the first step for most organizations, especially the ones like this, are to let the employees know that security is something that's important to the organization. And it has to come from the very top. And unfortunately, this is something that is often a problem, because if you ask a lot of cybersecurity professionals, they will tell you that the biggest headaches they have in security come from people who have chief on their business card. So the company has to let employees know that security is a priority. And then they have to start training to show the importance of cybersecurity, basically to show that all of the cost of cybersecurity, whether it's in dollars spent or effort expended or productivity shaved off, is an investment that is worthwhile and that will be repaid in lowering a risk posture, which generally involves a lowering in the overall cost of the organization. You know, when I was working with a group of sales professionals, when I managed salespeople and did sales training, we talked about the double sell and how difficult it was when you had to do a double sell. What does that mean? It means that before you can sell them on your idea, you have to sell them off of another idea. And in a lot of organizations, cybersecurity involves this double sell. So what do you do? You begin by selling them off of the idea that security is bad, that cybersecurity is somehow something that is a tick box for some regulator or auditor or some executive in a department that has nothing to do with profit and productivity, and sell them onto the idea that cybersecurity is a critical part of everything that they and everyone else in the organization does. Once you've sold them onto that idea, then you can start talking about specifics, and then you can work your way toward a culture of cybersecurity. Now, I'm going to turn first to Chebert. Brian, now I know that you'd spent a lot of time in government service where cybersecurity is heavily regulated, where there are some teeth that go behind making sure that cybersecurity is enforced. But you've also spent time in academia where cybersecurity can be an absolute nightmare. You know, what do you think about this idea of a culture having an impact on cybersecurity?
Oh, I totally agree. So let's go start with all my days in the military. Well, with the military. My biggest problem is actually very similar to the problem I had in academia, and that's entitlement. The chiefs, the principal investigators, the PhDs in academia, the head of X in the military. A lot of these folks have a attitude or a culture of entitlement. And thusly, those rules don't apply to me. My favorite example is this one physical security head, not cybersecurity, but physical security head, who decided he always liked playing such and such a game on the head IT person's workstation because he had the best workstation. Well, the problem is the server for, in this case, Novell Network, died. And the fastest machine was the IT manager's workstation. So we installed NetWare on that and left it on her desk running so that we could have the tape restore, get it running so that the admiral wouldn't chew a new one in us. Well, he comes over, sees that it's not a login screen, and reboots it because he wanted to play his game. Well, in academia, I had problems with, I'm a PI. I don't want all this X to get in the way of my research because research is what counts. And that level of entitlement, that culture, was an uphill battle. In fact, I still haven't won that battle. I've actually had to go and just make changes as policy within the systems to things like complex passwords, X number of characters, must be changed every X number of days, and just ignoring the yelling and screaming. There's a lot of problems with the entitlement and those that are in power. So I'll make one more comment about this, in that the current generation, that is getting into college and getting ready to graduate from college and going to be joining the job force. Some of those folks have an interesting culture of entitlement by themselves. They've had a lot of things handed to them. They've been patted on the back for every little bitty thing. And now they're taking this into the workforce. And some of these kids that I've met really and truly don't think cybersecurity is important. So we have the old timers causing problems. We have the new kids potentially causing problems. I think this is going to be a very hard row to hoe.
Well, you know, I think it can be a very hard row to hoe, especially when you have an organization that gives lip service to cybersecurity, but doesn't really value what it takes to achieve cybersecurity. Lou, how about from your perspective? You've been in various large organizations, and do you see that cybersecurity needs to be something that is talked about throughout the organization if it's going to be effective, or can it be something that is handled on a group by group or team by team basis?
You know, I think it needs to be not only talked about throughout the company, but it does need to also be modeled, modeling good behavior, so to speak, in local teams as well. And I think that's where the culture starts. Making sure that, management and so on are modeling good behavior. I've worked with organizations where, they'll do these campaigns. Well, they'll do phishing campaigns just to see how their users will go and react to things. And again, some people don't even realize that they're being tested. Some people do, and then they don't really talk about it or do anything about it afterwards to kind of do like a postmortem on it to make people realize what had happened, what they should have done, that kind of thing. And so like those types of things, you want to make sure you capitalize on when you do types of campaigns to educate your users. And then I'm sure make sure management is also pushing the fact that, hey, we got to make sure that we follow these types of rules and follow these processes and guidelines. And I think those are the types of things you need for teams. And when you see users in organizations trying to circumvent some of the tools because they're hitting their productivity, you know that there's a problem with that culture. You know that there's a problem with the way that they're doing things and the way that they're teaching things. And I think that's where organizations need to start, is just making sure that they ingrain it in their daily workforce and their daily conversation, and making sure that they do follow-ups and they model good behavior. I think all of those things will start engaging more people, no matter what generation they are, when it comes to security, and making sure it's part of their culture.
I think you're right. And I think that it's important to note that some organizations think that merely saying that they're going to put a huge penalty on you if you violate cybersecurity, or they're going to put a penalty if you don't take the training, whatever, those sticks don't matter nearly as much if they don't reflect the culture of the organization. If you have the culture that's going one way and somehow these written rules that it's understood you can ignore if it helps you get your job done better, that leads people to think that not only are the rules not applicable, but the culture, the company, is basically hypocritical, and that rules about other things don't matter either.
Right.
So for companies that are interested in cybersecurity, the first thing is get your cultural house in order, and a lot of good things will follow from that. Speaking of good things, Lou, I think it's time to turn it back over to you to help us move to the next part of an exciting episode of TWiET.
Well, thank you, Curtis. Next up, we have our guest. But before we get to our guest, we do have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Compiler, an original podcast from Red Hat discussing tech topics, big, small, and strange. Compiler comes to you from the makers of Command Line Heroes, another of our sponsors, and is hosted by Angela Andrews and Brent Simino. Now, technology can be big, bold, bizarre, and complicated. Compiler unravels industry topics, trends, and the things you've always wanted to know about tech through interviews with the people who know it best. On their show, you will hear a chorus of perspectives from the diverse communities behind the code. Compiler brings together a curious team of Red Hatters to tackle big questions in tech, like what is technical debt? What are tech hiring managers actually looking for? And do you have to know how to code to get started in open source? Now, episode 2 covers what can video games teach us about edge computing? The internet is a patchwork of international agreements and varying infrastructures, but there's something coming to change the ways we connect. In this episode of Compiler, hosts explore what edge computing mean for people who enjoy video games and what this form of entertainment could teach us about the technology. Episode 9, how are tech hubs changing? Traditionally, if someone wanted a career in tech, they have to make a move to a tech hub, a city packed with startups and talent. But things are starting to change. The hosts of Compiler speak to a few of the change makers who are thinking outside of the physical and social dimensions we've come to associate with innovation. I really enjoyed the edge computing episode. They did a pretty amazing job, actually, of distilling down what edge computing is and just how practical applications make it seem more accessible. Learn more about Compiler at red.ht/twit. New episodes are out now. Go and download them at any time and be sure to check back for new shows. Listen to Compiler on Apple Podcasts or anywhere you listen to your podcasts. We'll also include a link on today's episode show page. But many thanks to Compiler for their support of this week in enterprise tech. Well, folks, it's my favorite part of the show where we get to bring in a guest to drop some knowledge on the Twire Ryan. Today we have Ben Verde Chapman. He's Chief Growth Officer of GigWage. Welcome to the show, Ben.
Great to be here. Thanks so much.
Absolutely. Now, our audience loves to hear people's origin stories. Can you take us through your journey through tech and what brought you to GigWage?
Absolutely. I actually started my career in advertising. So I trained as a designer and in visual communication. I was headhunted out of university into advertising. And I thought I was really going to become kind of a Don Draper, Mad Men type character. I'd end up with a corner office and, a nice drinks cabinet. But I quickly realized that advertising wasn't for me. So I was looking for something different. I actually moved into digital publishing. I spent several years working for a publisher, taking them from kind of a magazine world into the digital world, which was very interesting. I learned a lot about launching digital products there. And then I kind of caught the startup bug about a decade ago. And as you can hear, I'm not originally from the States. So I moved soon after that to the US with a company that I was working for. And I joined them really as kind of one of the first employees. And we were building out an identity platform. It was facial recognition biometrics. So I spent a number of years there kind of growing that company. And I was consulting and working with a number of other startups. So I've sort of become this kind of generalist, very much a designer at heart, but have become, a salesperson, a marketer, a product manager, even got my hands dirty with some code along the way. So I now find myself in the world of fintech at GigWage. So yeah, I'm not a typical guest, I imagine, on this show. So hopefully I can share a few insights if listeners are looking to switch up their career or make a move from one discipline to another. I can definitely provide some insights there.
Fantastic. Yeah. I think that GigWage in general, the gig economy is a big economy. Things are continually changing there. GigWage is a platform, payroll platform in there. And that puts you guys in a really good position for you to understand how the workforces operate and the financial needs there. So I'm actually very interested in some of the data you guys have come up with here. Your organization has actually been doing some pretty interesting research in this area. Can you take us through some of that?
Yeah, sure. And we partnered with the Commonwealth Organization. So they're a national nonprofit. And for about 20 years now, they've been looking to improve the financial security of workers. And we partnered to run a study on a population of gig workers over in Texas, where the company is actually based. And really, this was to figure out what were some of the financial needs that we, you know, these workers were actually looking for, and how could we provide those, like the kind of type of product that we could provide into that group that would potentially help them. So we had a phase of this project ran for 4 months, and we tested three sort of benefit, like financial benefits, that we tried to kind of bring into that group. Really, they were designed for sort of mitigating the income instability that many gig workers experience. So on the one hand, you have this massively growing gig economy, right? Which is really opening up and completely changing the movement of labor, not just in the US. This is a global sort of phenomenon. You know, typically people think of Uber or Lyft or DoorDash, but there's actually this whole sort of spectrum of different types of workers that are basically running our society behind the scenes, but are undervalued by the society. There aren't the safety nets in place at the moment that can really help them. So they have access to labor. They can basically press a button and earn money, but there's also not the financial security that you would typically enjoy if you were more of a W-2, you know, typical kind of employer, employee relations. So yeah, this study was really to try and understand what sort of financial tools could we give to these workers that would help them overcome some of that volatility and give some financial security. So we had, you know, reoccurring stipends, we had emergency grants, and we also had low interest loans. So of around the 60 workers that we had, 43 ended up becoming participants, and they kind of continued through that pilot. And just here's a, again, this really speaks to the nature of the gig economy. A lot of that is low to moderate income workers, right, and disproportionately from the Black and Latinx community. So again, on the one hand, the gig economy is basically the future of work. However, it's not really set up to support the players in that ecosystem. So that's why this was an important study. And I think we use this to educate, you know, our customers and partners about the opportunity of the gig economy, but also some of the challenges that we have as this thing kind of matures.
Now, you brought up a good point. Obviously, you know, with the gig economy, the income is slightly volatile, obviously, depending on when how much people want to work, you know, what, you know, the amount of time they work. But there's not always going to be business in that area as well. So there's lots of challenges there. It sounds like this particular study attempted to try out some things. You talked about a couple of them. How are those actually impacting things? Are they actually showing improvement? Are they adding stability? Or, you know, what's the change there? Are you seeing any increase or any better, anything getting better there at all?
Yeah, I think, and it's very nuanced. So let's take the, you know, the $1,000 emergency grant. So this was accepted by, you know, nearly 75% of the participants. And this was, we're told through the surveying that we did, this right. was used to cover things like, you know, rent, utilities, paying for cars, even medical expenses. But the $1,000 wasn't considered enough. So it was kind of welcome, but it was an insufficient amount, based on the really quite large degree of volatility around the group that we studied with, around their income. And that was a result of their scheduling volatility. So actually being able to work was the thing that gave them that income volatility. So the $1,000 was helpful, and it went to good causes, but it wasn't enough. That was basically what our research showed us. Mm.
It's interesting. So they, I mean, obviously, you know, it sounds like these types of jobs, they need something. And it sounds like this particular type of thing is not going to necessarily help them all. And again, the question would be also, you know, in this case, the money that you were giving them, this was coming from the research fund, correct? Like, but in most cases, it would mean that the organization that is has developed the gig economy, let's say the Ubers or the Lyfts, would have to pay that if they wanted to help their people, correct?
Yeah, and this study, we had a banking partner as well, which provided some of the funding. So I think what this shows is, yes, you need to have the funding in place, but there's also, what sort of other partners can you get involved to help really support the not just the growth of that, the gig economy, but it's really the workers. Like, how can we get them access to things like financial tools? I mean, it doesn't necessarily have to be hard cash. It could be things like, income visibility. Having an income report is very important and is lacking in particular inside the gig economy. So we have a story of, consumers of our technology through our customers, a six-figure earning truck driver, can't get a mortgage because they aren't able to prove their income visibility to their lender. So it's not just always about the hard money. That obviously helps, but it's also about what are the other tools we can provide to help these people, millions of people, get into the credit system and actually become visible, become acknowledged by the institutions that run our society, and allow other workers who enjoy, more of a traditional kind of employer-employee relation, access to these economic tools. So that's really the bigger picture, I think, is it's not just about the cold hard cash. It's actually about access to other services and other ways of creating financial freedom. That's really what this is all about. So I think, this study is actually going to continue on with other partners to further explore some of these other areas as well. So we'll be looking forward to those results.
Now, in the participants, can you share what part of the market were they in? Were they the Ubers of the world or the Lyfts of the world, or were they just different types of organizations and types of gig workers?
So I understand they were part of a healthcare organization. So that's likely to be sort of on-demand care workers or nurses. So this was run during the height of COVID. So it's kind of very timely, I guess, that it would be a healthcare organization that this study was run on, because they were obviously under probably the heaviest level of stress and vulnerability whilst the pandemic was peaking.
Right. It's very interesting. Now, I want to talk a little bit about GigWage, because it's an interesting company. You mentioned it's a fintech company. I understand it as a payroll platform for the gig worker and gig economy type organizations. Can you take us a little bit through what it offers and how it can help organizations through situations like this?
Yeah, sure. So, yeah, we're kind of at our core, we're a contractor payments platform. So we allow employers to easily pay their contract freelance independent workforce, increasingly known as the gig worker. The underlying technology that we've built to provide that service, we're also exposing through an API-first platform. So basically, all of the financial tools and services that we use to build our products, we now make available to other organizations, other large platforms that are looking to build out their own payment or payroll or banking services. So that's where we're starting to, I don't want to use the word pivot, it's kind of a trendy word in tech, but we've certainly evolved as an organization from just the payment and payroll solution into now more of an infrastructure play, driven by this API model. And we take legacy technology. So an example would be, you know, filing a 1099 in with the IRS. That's actually a very cumbersome process. I'm sure many of you have not done it, but trust me, it's very cumbersome from a technological point of view. So we actually abstract that out and make it very simple. So now you're not dealing with kind of a government system. You're dealing with, you know, basically a fintech platform, and we make it very seamless to just, you know, file that away in an automated way. So that's kind of one example of how we're trying to build out this infrastructure for the gig economy, because as more companies go into it and start to, you know, hire more on-demand workers, the things that we've been talking about, this financial stability, income visibility, compliance, these are all the features that companies and organizations will need to effectively transition into becoming kind of a gig economy organization. And there's, you know, plenty of data to support the growth of that economy. So it's really a case of, like, not if, but when that kind of makes a full transition.
Well, we have lots more to talk about here, but before we do have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Plextrack, the premier cybersecurity reporting and workflow management platform that empowers teams to win the right security battles. Now, what if you could streamline the communication across the entire security department so that every security team member would do their job more efficiently? From simplified data aggregation and reporting to integrated ticketing for remediation to analytics, visualizations for board reporting, Plextrack touches every aspect of the security management workflow. Gain a real-time view of your security posture by bringing all your data sources together into one powerful platform where you can triage scanner results, generate powerful analytics and visualizations, assign remediation tasks, attest to your posture, and track progress over time. As a satisfied Plextrack client put it, we see Plextrack as a part of our strategy to move quicker and be productive. Now we have a real-time view of what we need to focus on, and I have an easy way of showing senior leadership. Plextrack serves every aspect of the Enterprise Security Team program with features designed to improve workflow, collaboration, and communication for each role, including Red Team data aggregation. Import data from all of your automated vulnerability scanners and tools, triage and report results in half the time. Blue Team remediation, assign remediation tasks right on the platform or through simple integrations with ticketing tools your team already uses, and track progress over time. Stakeholder communication, you can use powerful yet simple analytics to attest to security posture and prioritize issues. Tailor attestation and communication to the needs of both team members and the C-suite. Plus continuous purple teaming assessment. Begin purple teaming or power up your current strategies with Runbooks, the best in industry tool for test execution. Security teams of all sizes and maturities can maximize the efficiency and effectiveness of their workflows with Plextrack. Customers report that they see Plextrack as part of our strategy to move quicker and be proactive. The platform has a 5x return on investment in year one, and that it gives their cybersecurity operations a 30% increase in efficiency. Plextrack improves the entire security engagement lifecycle by making it easy to generate security reports, deliver them securely, and track issues to completion straight from the platform. Book a demo today. Try Plextrack free for 1 month and see how it can change your life as a security professional. Simply go to plextrack.com/twit and claim your free month. That's plextrack.com/twit. And we thank Plextrack for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, we've been talking with Ben Verichamin. He's Chief Growth Officer at GigWage. We've been talking about the gig economy and just how complex it actually is. I do want to bring my co-host back in. I want to start with Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis?
Thanks so much, Lou. Ben, I've got a question, and this is going to seem perhaps blunt, but I've got to ask it. You talk about the benefits that you can bring to the gig workers, and that sounds fabulous, but your customers are really the companies that employ the gig workers. why do they care? I mean, isn't part of the whole gig economy that they can pay for some services from the individuals and not have to worry about all this silly stuff like, you know, retirement and health care and all the other things that come with full employment?
Yes, I mean, that would be the logical conclusion. But when we speak to customers, our customers, which, by the way, are across a spectrum of industries, and that's something that surprised me when I joined the company, and I've been here around 2 months now. My assumption was, oh, we're just working with the Ubers, you know, ride sharing and delivery. And it couldn't be further from the truth. And actually what's happening is there's smaller companies that rely on talented contracted workforces, to thrive and grow. And it's very important to them that they have a happy workforce. While they might not be classified as employees in the traditional sense, they are fundamental to the success of that company. One example is, you know, a therapist group, a mental health therapist group that we work with. These are trained professionals who happen to be gig workers. They have decided to, you know, be independent from any one particular organization and work in a flexible way, and provide a very valuable service to their communities. So the organization that they work through, it's very important that they have a happy contractor workforce. They need to be paid almost immediately. So they can't be waiting a couple of weeks to get their money. They do their work, they expect to be paid. And when we speak to them about other services, benefits that they could provide to their contractor workforce, they're all ears. So I had the same skepticism that you have, and that does exist, no doubt, in certain industries. But overwhelmingly, the customers that we work with, the companies that we work with, they see it as a competitive advantage to provide their contract workforce with not just financial tools, but perks, benefits, things that will make their life better and loyal to that brand. So that's was surprising to me, and it might be surprising to you based on your question there.
Well, and, you know, in full disclosure, I spent I have spent many years of my career in what is now called the gig economy. We called it freelancing. Right. When I was doing the bulk of it. So I understand this side of things, you know, very well. I've also been an editor with companies using freelance talent. So I have been the person who sends out the assignments and ultimately the checks to gig workers, as we call them now. So, you know, I do have, I think, an understanding. And one of the things that I'm curious about is that in the last 2 or 3 years, we've heard a great deal of talk about people increasingly going into the gig economy. People who, for whatever reasons, either by their choice or not, no longer have that single large contractor that most employers tend to be, but are now working for a bunch of different contractors. From the economic trends that you see, do you see this growing? I mean, do you think that more people are going to have multiple sources of income versus the one large source that a traditional job represents?
Yeah, and I think there's on the data side, and this is well written about on the internet, so it's not just our kind of research. It's something like 50% of the US workforce will be classified as independent workers by 2025 and 2030. So this, you know, this thing is done from my point of view. This thing has happened. It's now a case of, you know, what does it look like over the next 5 to 10 years when, you know, over half the workforce in some capacity is participating in the gig economy? Now, that could be, and I freelanced myself, for a number of years. And, you know, you need to understand, again, this spectrum of gig worker. Like, what does that really mean? Because on the one hand, you have the sort of on-demand, you know, delivering food, you know, perhaps they're driving, you know, rideshare. And then you have the, you know, knowledge worker who is, you know, providing an extremely valuable service as a contractor, as a freelancer. So that's really where, you know, on the one hand, it's freelance has always been a thing, but now through technology, and I think accelerated by things like the lockdown, the COVID, and also this shift to remote work, the definition of a gig worker has changed, certainly, even from the likes of an Uber or a DoorDash. It's still continuing to change. So, you know, the data's there at the macro level. And, you know, I look at our dashboards every morning and I see that our customers are bringing on more and more contractors. They are growing. They're not just relying on the same group. They are adding more workers and paying more money to those workers. So I think this thing is absolutely, you know, on rails. It's moving forward. It's growing. And it's a very exciting time to be part of that. And why our company exists really is for that reason, to try and accelerate that shift from the traditional workforce to the gig workforce.
Well, you've talked about the shift and the difference between the traditional employer and what's experienced in the gig workplace. Your company is providing some tangible benefits to the contracted people that are contracted and paid through your company. Can you foresee a time? Do you think the trend will ever get to the point where there are other things? I mean, one of the traditional advantages of an employer is that there are certain benefits in the U.S., things like health care, some sort of retirement, all that kind of thing that comes from employment that is notably difficult to find from freelancers or gig workers. Do you see a company like yours ultimately helping to bridge some of that and add some of those traditional benefits so that there's less of this gulf between traditional employees and gig workers in what they can experience?
Absolutely. And I'm going to embody our CEO right now. And he's a very cool guy. I'm not cool, but he will say gig wage will be the default company to do that. That's our vision. That's our mission, is to be the default infrastructure for delivering that that level of, you know, social safety net for the underrepresented workers, which predominantly make up the gig economy. So again, going back to the Commonwealth study that I was speaking about before the ad, that's why that research is so important, because this is not just some company, you know, evangelizing their technology. This is real evidence. This is what is going to happen in the future. So that's why that study was so important. And I think it's kind of an unusual time that we live in because of the last 2 years. A lot of things have been accelerated. So, you know, the explosion of people coming into the gig economy in very kind of atypical ways. So, you know, there was a great article a couple of weeks ago about how a lot of retirees were now coming back into the workforce, not because necessarily they needed the money, although that was one of the motivators, but also their employers were keen to get their talent back into operation. So this is a very nuanced, rapidly changing sort of macro story. And we get to see it sort of boots on the ground as well, like kind of at street level through these different companies that are basically they're building their entire value proposition around growing through the use of contract workers, or providing a means of getting into entrepreneurship. And there's a company that I'll be speaking about shortly. You know, they're basically a marketplace for rental vehicles, and the owners of those vehicles are effectively entrepreneurs, and they are now selling their product through a marketplace. So this gig economy is very nuanced. We have a lot of educational work that we have to do with partners and customers, because it isn't immediately understood exactly what the gig economy is and how it impacts companies. So yeah, that's where we are in terms of the evolutionary cycle.
So I've been in a position where I've had to utilize temp agencies over and over again, but I've been frustrated because I didn't really have control over that talent pool. Would you be willing to speculate whether this, what you're talking about with the gig economy, is that like maybe a middle ground? It's not a temp, but it is more of a, you know, a more well-known pool.
Yeah, and I think you know, we're a fintech company. We're not an HR platform. That's not to say we won't be in the future, but you know, we see in the marketplace that there's companies that will provide that service. So it's about vetting talent. It's about making sure that you can match the right person for the job, for the role. So I don't know about it being a middle ground. I think it's more about looking at perhaps the temp agency is more in the traditional model than the new model. So I couldn't comment or speculate too much on that. But I think it's increasingly we're seeing that even the talent that works for something like a temp agency won't necessarily have a loyalty towards that agency. I believe they would rather go direct into the companies, or go through a more modern sort of marketplace, talent marketplace. So that's, again, my kind of round the houses answer to your question.
Well, why don't I ask the question just a little differently then?
Sure.
More and more corporations, more and more organizations are looking at gig workers. Obviously, there's a lot of benefits to it. So what kinds of organizations, what should people be looking at within their own organization to see about a fit? You know, who can they talk to you guys directly and get some consulting, or, you know, a judgment call on how good a fit it might be?
Again, we're not really involved in the sort of recruitment or sourcing of talent. And we actually have a little bit of a barrier between us and the actual contracted people. So we're working with the businesses that are bringing on the contractors.
How do we determine whether it's going to be appropriate?
If someone's looking at going gig rather than temp, what
are the check marks that we should be looking at within each organization, whether or not there's going to be a fit to make this move?
Right. Understood. Okay. I think, you know, part of it is the onboarding experience. So, you know, how do they philosophically think about talent? Again, in the traditional sense, and I've kind of been on both ends of this as a looking for freelancers and a freelancer, they can very quickly, you can get into the mindset of, I just need to, you know, basically fill a seat for a couple of days. And that's really the priority, is getting somebody to do the job. The quality of the work isn't necessarily the sort of motivating factor. So there's that to consider. And then the experience of the contractor going through that process. Do they feel like they are valued as a participant in that organization? Are they being paid on time? Are they integrated through the system? So there's a number of different sort of, I guess you kind of like the life cycle management of a contractor is something you have to kind of look at. In terms of vetting it, because it is so different, depending on the type of work and the type of gig worker that you're looking for, you know, I think it'd be very hard to kind of come up with a single sort of rubric around that. But it's all about, you know, I think leveraging technology to make the contractor experience much better, because they aren't going to hang around with you as a company if you ain't paying them on time, if you aren't giving them access to their money as quickly as possible, and they feel that they can come and work for you in an easy way, they will go and find work somewhere else. So the power has shifted to the contractor now, and companies are realizing that they have to button up their process. They actually have to learn how to respect the gig worker a lot more.
Well, folks, time flies when you are having fun. Ben, thank you so much for being here. Before we close up, though, I do want to give you a chance to tell the folks at home where they can maybe learn more about GigWage and where they can get started.
Sure. So you can obviously go to gigwage.com, and we have all of our products listed there. You can even sign up for our SaaS solution, which is a very easy to use contractor payment and payroll product. You can actually be paying your contractors within minutes of signing up. So that's a full kind of contractor life cycle management, from onboarding, payment, TIN checks, W-9 collection, all the way through to 1099 filing and income reports. So that's very popular. That's really kind of where we started as an organization. And then we have our API platform, which makes available all of our services that we use that we built the product with. So payment, payroll, filing, tax, compliance. You can get that and integrate that or embed it into your own platform. So we have customers, an example, this RV customer of ours, Outdoorsy, they're the number one RV marketplace in the US. They actually embed our technology into their platform and provide that to their customers, who are the hosts and users of the RV product. So they're actually able to automatically file tens of thousands of 1099 forms, which if you've ever filed a 1099 form, you know, is very painful. If you have to do tens of thousands of them, you have to have an automated way of doing that. So we allowed them to build that system directly into their platform. We're kind of hidden inside their software and provide that service through an API. And this is really one of the core use cases of GigWage from a platform perspective, is being able to not just onboard massive amounts of contractors and pay them, but also to have a continuous state of compliance. Tax compliance is a very, very important and often overlooked part of running a contractor-dependent business. And with last year's American Rescue Act, the threshold went way down on a 1099-K. So it used to be $20,000. If you're paying out $20,000, you had to file a 1099-K. It's now $600. So you can imagine, you go from hundreds to tens of thousands, if not millions, of now forms that need to be filed. And if you don't file those, the federal government will come and get busy on you, basically, for the right. tune of, you know, hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars in fines. So that's one of the core use cases of our platform outside of the you know, payment and payroll for the contractors. And you can learn more about that at gigwage.com. Or follow me on LinkedIn, because I'm always talking about it.
Awesome. Thanks again, Ben. Well, folks, you've done it again. You sat through another hour of the best dang enterprise and IT podcast in the universe. So definitely tune your podcatcher to Twyatt. I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to the co-host, starting with our very own Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis, what's going on for you in the coming week, and where can people find you and all of your work?
Well, when I'm back at work next week, we're going to be looking at a number of things for our subscribers. I've put a new data resource in the database on cybersecurity awareness training around the world. I'm getting ready for RSA, so I will be responding to some of the companies that have invited me to meet with them. Also getting ready to head out to a company's conference the week after that, and beginning to put together my presentation for the Omdia Analyst Summit at Black Hat, which is going to be the first week in August. You know, I'll be in person in Las Vegas for Black Hat and DEF CON. So lots going on, as well as in June, I've got a webinar coming up on what it takes to find all kinds of gross things in your IT subsystem internally. Basically, what it takes to recognize supply chain, software supply chain issues when they've already started to have an impact. So would love for folks to go over to darkreading.com, the Omdia tab, sign up. I'd love to see you there and hear your questions about the software supply chain.
Thank you again, Curtis, for being here and ending your week with Twyatt. Well, folks, we also thank our very own Mr. Brian Chi as well. Cheeber, what's going on for you in the coming week, and where can people find you?
Well, I'm going to be playing at MegaCon this weekend, and this coming week, it's recovery time and yard work and such. But you know what? I'm going to give a shout out. I just got a new camera. It's called Center Cam. It's teeny tiny, and it's on a flexible hose and a clip at the top of the monitor, so I can actually center the camera right in the middle of my monitor. So I hope you noticed that as I'm reading and talking about different articles, I was actually looking at the camera instead of in profile. So kind of a cool camera that give them a shout out, because it's a neat product. And if you're doing podcasts and so forth, you might want to consider it, especially since it's so small and can coil up that it'd be great for travel. Anyway, we'd love to hear from you. My Twitter address is ADVNETLAB, Advanced Net Lab. And, you know, we get all kinds of interesting discussions. I actually just posted a video. One of the people at MegaCon with our makerspace, she created one of the guardians from Zelda. And there it is. And so that's actually part of the cosplay contest at MegaCon. Well, you're also welcome to throw me email. I'm Chebert, spelled Cheebert at twit.tv. Or if you'd like, throw an email at twyatt@twit.tv, and that'll hit all the hosts. We'd love to hear from you. We supposedly have viewers on every single continent on Earth. I think we still have that claim. And we'd like to hear from you. And if you aren't comfortable with English, throw it at us in your native language, and we're going to use a machine translator and try and answer your questions. Love to hear from you.
Thank you, Cheeber. Well, folks, we also have to thank you as well. You're the person who drops in each and every week to watch and to listen to our show and get your enterprise goodness. We want to make it easy for you to watch and listen and catch up on your enterprise and IT news. So go to our show page right now, twit.tv/Twyatt. There you'll find all the amazing back episodes, the show notes, the co-host information, the guest information, of course, the links of the stories that we do during the show. But more importantly, next to those videos there, you'll get those helpful subscribe and download links. Support the show by getting your audio version or your video version of your choice. Listen on any one of your podcast applications. We're on all of them, so definitely subscribe and support the show. But you may have also heard, we also have Club Twit as well. That's right. It's a members-only ad-free podcast service with a bonus Twit Plus feed that you can't get anywhere else, and it's only $7 a month. And there are a lot of great things that come with Club Twit. In fact, one of them is the exclusive access to the members-only Discord server. Lots of great channels on there, chat with hosts, producers, separate discussion channels. Plus, there's also lots of special events on there as well. Lots of fun tech topics. But of course, definitely join Club Twit and be part of that movement. Go to twit.tv/clubtwit. But Club Twit also offers corporate group plans as well. That's right. For your organization, it's a great way to give your team access to the ad-free tech podcast that we do. The plans start with 5 members at a discounted rate of $6 each per month, and you can add as many seats as you'd like. This is a great way for your IT departments, your sales departments, your developers, your tech teams, whoever, stay on top and all up to date with access to all of our podcasts. And just like regular memberships, they can join the Discord server as well as get that Twit Plus bonus feed as well. So definitely join Club Twit at twit.tv/clubtwit. Now, after you subscribe, you can impress your friends, your family members, your coworkers with the gift of Twit, because we talk a lot about fun tech topics here on the show. And we think they'll find it fun and interesting as well. So definitely give it to them. Plus, if you've already subscribed and you're available on Fridays, 1:30 p.m. Pacific time, we do this show live. That's right. Check it out live at live.twit.tv. That's where we have all the streams. Come see the behind the scenes. Come see how the pizza's made, all the banters, all the mistakes that we make. Well, at least I make. And of course, come see and join the chat room as well. It's a main A lot of famous characters in there at irc.twit.tv. If you're going to watch the show live, you might as well join that chat room as well at irc.twit.tv. Definitely hit me up on twitter.com/LouMM. There I post all my enterprise tidbits. Direct message me, send me messages. I want to hear show titles. I want to hear show ideas. Definitely hit me up there if you want to have a good conversation. Also, if you want to know what I do during my normal work week at Microsoft, go to developers.microsoft.com/office. There we post the latest and greatest ways for you to make your office experience more productive for your organization. Plus, remember, Build. That's right. Build's coming up next week. Definitely check that out. There'll be a lot of great sessions. It'll be virtual. You'll hear a lot about some very interesting things that are coming out here in 2022. So definitely check out build@microsoft.com. Well, folks, I also want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to Leo and Lisa. They continue to support This Week in Enterprise Tech each and every week, and we couldn't do the show without them. So thank you, Leo and Lisa, for all their support over the years. I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, and I want to thank all the staff and engineers at SWIT. Of course, I also want to thank our very own Mr. Brian Chi. One more time, he's not only our co-host, but he's also our tireless producer. That's right. He does all the bookings for the show. And of course, the plannings for the show, and we couldn't do the show without him. So thank you, Chibert, for all your support. And before we sign out, I want to thank our editor for today, Mr. Victor. He makes us look good after the fact. So thank you, editor. Thank you, Victor. And of course, we also have to thank our very own TD for today. He's the talented Mr. Ant Pruitt. He does an amazing show called Hands-On Photography here on Twit. Ant, what's going on Hands-On Photography this week?
Well, this week, I basically told folks they need to go ahead and spend a little bit of money, you know, because we're talking tripods, and people like to buy cheap tripods. And let me tell you, don't do that. So go check out the discussion, twit.tv/hop. And I recommend a couple of different tripods out there. And you don't have to spend a gazillion dollars, but just spend more than $10 on a tripod, please and thank you.
I am a culprit of that, so I will have to go watch that episode. Thank you, Ann. And until next time, I'm Louis Maresca, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.
Hey, I'm Rod Pyle, editor of Ad Astra magazine, and each week I'm joined by Tarek Malik, the editor-in-chief over at space.com, in our new This Week in Space podcast. Every Friday, Tarek and I take a deep dive into the stories that define the new space age. What's NASA up to? When will Americans once again set foot on the moon? And how about those samples from the Perseverance rover? When are those coming home? What the heck has Elon Musk done now? In addition to all the latest and greatest in space exploration, we'll take an occasional look at bits of spaceflight history that you probably never heard of, and all with an eye towards having a good time along the way. Check us out in your favorite podcatcher.